Welcome to episode 90, which is part one of a two-part episode all about ways we can talk to younger generations, like our kids, about their bodies. Why am I covering this on the Pelvic Floor Project? I treat mainly adults, but all adults were once kids. A big part of what we do as pelvic health physios is educate people about their private parts, how the pee system works, how the digestive system and pooping mechanisms work, how our pelvic floor is related to sex and inserting tampons. It's all very practical information because we all experience these bodily functions, but most clients are shocked by what they didn't know. Why don't we learn about this in our basic schooling? My parents never talked to me about this stuff. I'm thrilled to have Jenny, a sexual health education teacher from the Central Okanagan Public School District, with me today. She's here with me for the next two episodes to talk about what kids are learning in school, because they learn more than you think. I can just picture my daughter listening, but also giggling with her friends half the time, probably not taking it all in. And you know what it's like as a parent when you ask your kids, "What did you learn in school today?" Nothing. Jenny's going to share the curriculum and what they learn in each grade, from the names of anatomical parts to puberty, periods, what kinds of touching is not okay, healthy relationships, and intimacy. In this first episode, we'll be covering the elementary years, and in the next episode, the middle and high school years. You'll hear me tie the pelvic floor in throughout to see how the things we learn as kids can often frame our adult symptoms. The goal of these episodes is to help you not only hear what your kids are learning, but also how to enhance their learning at home and give you ideas of how to talk to them. Listeners, have you ever heard of the benefits of using a high-quality compression garment during pregnancy, after birth, or to address feelings of vulnerability, maybe in your tummy, or heaviness in your undercarriage? Did you know the evidence tells us that using these garments can decrease pain, ease apprehension, and increase the ability to move with comfort in your day if you have these unwanted symptoms? I'm grateful to have SRC Health as a podcast sponsor, and I want to take the time to tell you about their high-quality products. Using a revolutionary fabric created by medical professionals, SRC has designed a line of compression shorts and leggings that are made to support your back, tummy, and pelvis in pregnancy, or help you feel less pain and more confident with movement as you recover after pelvic surgery or birth. Their products have helped many for symptoms like incontinence, diastasis, and prolapse. I also have to add their customer service is like no other because they stand behind their products. Check out their full line. Head to their website, www.srchealth, and enter the code THEPELVICFLOORPROJECT, all capital letters, at the checkout because you'll get 10% off. Don't your mind and body deserve the support? All right, Jenny, I'm so thankful to have you here today. This is an episode that I've been really looking forward to covering, not only because I think it will help so many of my clients, but I'm interested as a parent in our discussion today. So I really appreciate you taking the time today because I know you're a busy lady.
Well, thank you for having me.
So why I wanted to cover this is for several different reasons, but I myself don't treat too many children. I treat mainly adults as a pelvic health physio, and there's some themes that seem to be very prominent. One of them being kind of this one. I do a lot of education in my job to help people understand their embarrassing symptoms that bring them in. And as we do, you know, talk about anatomy or talk about how normal it is for people to experience some of these symptoms, I find sometimes there's almost a disappointment in these adults that, why didn't I learn these simple things as a child? And so part of me thought, well, there's still a lot of opportunity to teach our children. And so they quite often have questions around, how do I help my daughter or my son do this better than I did? That's one reason. And then I think another reason is just like, even as a parent, I know my kids are learning some of this in school, but they don't tell me. I get a very abbreviated version of what's going on. And then I think that I'm so interested in what you have to say because it'll help me communicate with my kids. Sometimes I don't even know. I know how to teach adults, but everything's different when it's your own child. And so I really look forward to this discussion. And before we get going, Jenny, will you share just a little bit about who you are for the listeners so they understand your background?
I'm Jenny, and I'm one of the sexual health educators for School District 23. And I have been in this job now for 19 years. And I started off teaching, I guess, science and physical education. And the curriculum for sexual health actually fits into the physical education curriculum. And because it's physical and health education, so there's mental health, sexual health, and physical health. And so then I just kind of fell into it naturally teaching phys ed and in another district. And then I moved up here and the job got posted. And then I just have done extra training, over the years through Options for Sexual Health and some places back in Montreal. So that's all I've been teaching basically from September to June for the last 19 years. So. And I have two kids of my own too. So I fully understand, like kids and sometimes the nervousness or anxiety around learning about this too. Yeah.
And I think, so I think about like, let's say my daughter, I know that someone from your group talked to my daughter's class last year. And I remember doing some of this as a kid in school as well. And I remember it being embarrassing to sit through that. And I was interested, but I didn't want to admit that I was interested because you just felt like you'd be teased or something like that. And I remember my daughter coming home and saying, we had so-and-so today to talk to us about our body. And it was so embarrassing. We had to say, all she told me was we had to say penis really loud. And that's all I heard. And so I really look forward to you helping everybody understand like what is being taught in the schools. And I think if I have this right, Jenny, it wouldn't necessarily be the same for every school district. Or will you speak a little bit to, because I know you can only speak to kind of this school district in your program. Mm-hmm. So is this something that, share a little bit about the curriculum. I want to ask you a little bit about what they're learning in each year, but can you share a little bit more about the, how each district might be different?
Yeah. So it was interesting when I first moved to this area, they didn't have sexual health teachers at that point. They had the classroom teachers teaching it. And I think it was about 2004, there was a survey that was put out to teachers, students, and parents asking how they would like to have it taught. Because it was PE teachers teaching it. It was also separated, males, females in one room. And so what happened was the survey basically came back saying, we want outside people coming in. We want a consistent message across all grades, because what was happening before is some teachers were comfortable, some weren't. So some kids were getting it, some weren't. And again, the comfort level of teachers. One of the biggest thing students said was it would be awkward having our teacher teach it, because then we would have to see them every day. Mm-hmm. Right. So we're not necessarily going to ask them questions that we would ask an outsider coming in. And feel more comfortable and safe in that situation. Anyway, so we are really fortunate. And I feel like that too, having kids in this district, not just because I teach it, but the fact that our district in the whole province, I think we're the only ones who have designated sexual health teachers. And when I started in 2005, there was only two of us. And now this year, we're now up to four sexual health teachers. Hmm. And so we teach grades 4 to grade 11 now. And in the younger grades, so basically 4, 5, 6, the focus is primarily, and a little bit of 7 is focused primarily on puberty. So the social, emotional, and physical, mostly physical changes of puberty. And then grade 7, we talk a little bit about, disease prevention, kind of leading into sexually transmitted infections, because that's kind of where the curriculum starts to go. And then also on boundaries and safety, sort of sexual harassment. And then grade 8, 9, 10, 11, the main focus is on healthy relationships and versus unhealthy. What do those look like? Sexual decision making, so giving them some information to help with good choices in their futures. And then the huge focus from basically kindergarten, which we don't do, all the way through to grade 12 is consent.
That's great. And everything is so different now. And obviously, language is more inclusive. And, we don't talk as much about gender. And I'm curious to know, will you just speak to that? How do you it seems like a messy topic sometimes, but how do you now, when you're using language in the classroom around gender, around body parts? It sounds, everyone's in the class together now, but how do you negotiate that?
That's a great question because I know there's a lot of misinformation. I think sometimes parents hear SOGI, which is stands for sexual orientation and gender identity, and they think that we are SOGI. We are sexual health education. SOGI is an overlying idea of trying to make sure all students feel included in every single subject area. It's not just in our subject area. So there's that. Whenever we talk about bodies, we refer to body parts. So we first of all distinguish between gender being identity and biological sex meaning reproductive systems. And so we tell kids that we're talking about reproductive systems. And so we will they will hear us use language like, if a person has testicles, if a person has ovaries and a vulva, this is what's going to happen to their bodies. So we kind of leave the gender out of it so that no matter what gender a person identifies as, they'll know what will happen to their body if depending on which body they're in.
So one of the things it sounds like, the grade fours and fives maybe are getting is some anatomy education around different body parts. And I think this is such a new thing actually too. I doubt I heard the term vulva before my area of work, before I got into this area. I think it was always just vagina or penis. That was kind of all, you either have a vagina or a penis. And I think now kids are learning much younger the differentiation about everything around in, let's say, in like female anatomy, or is just more kind of there's a vulva with labia, with a clitoris, with a vagina, with a urethra, instead of just this is all the vagina.
Well, and I think the terminology for sure, we want people to understand their anatomy. And the previous teachings was focusing on, oh, you have a vagina. And then people would think, oh, they urinate out of the vagina. And people are always like blown away. They're like, what? I don't. And so that language in the school system, in the primary grades, like K to three, there's a program called Kids in the Know, which is a personal safety program. And teachers, and this is around the whole province, teachers should be teaching about the private parts of the body. And so the word vulva is what they say, even at the younger ages, to be using for terminology. And we're hoping, like some kids know that word, like even before they come into our program from school, but some parents will use the word vulva. Some parents are still using kind of made up silly names for body parts. And I don't know if that's, previous generations' discomfort, like not talking about it at home ever, and it sort of almost being a taboo subject. But yeah, for sure, we want correct terminology, vulva. A lot of kids don't know what the scrotum is. And so we talk about the scrotum and
And also too, do you talk a little bit about, I asked for some of your ideas before we recorded this, and even too, you talk even about circumcision, right? And that some people have foreskin, some won't. Tell me a little bit more about that.
We just talk about it because in the early days of me teaching this, sometimes like we weren't necessarily talking about that at the time, and part of it was we didn't have as much time dedicated to the subject as we do now. But some kids would come up to me, they're like, how do I know if I'm circumcised? what does that mean for me? Like, are things going to work differently? Why do people have that done? So we kind of go through that. We talk about proper hygiene around if you have a foreskin, trying to make sure to pull that skin back to clean underneath if they're able to. And again, the cultural and religious beliefs sometimes, I learned something new. A student told me that in his culture, and he was from the Philippines. He said that people get circumcised because they believe it will make them taller. So I learned stuff from the kids all the time too. But yeah, we do talk about it. Sometimes it's come up because kids have babysat for different families and they're changing diapers. And so they don't understand why sometimes penises look different, right?
What a good point. And I think so. I'm guessing that you use pictures or models or something like that to show the anatomy.
Yeah, so we use diagrams. And like I think one of the things that kids get nervous about is they think that we're going to show them real private parts. And so right off the bat, we try to ease kids. We're just like, hey, at no point are we ever, all the way through all your years of sexual health, we're never showing you real pictures. We're always using diagrams. So
And I think about that as, as someone that sees adults, that that is a very common theme, is no one told me about this, and just normalizing it. I don't want to say I made the mistake, but with my oldest, I think I just used the term vagina initially. I think just my reason would have been simplicity and
yeah.
just like a very early word. And as soon as she got a bit older and I was like, I'm not doing this properly, I should be using the proper terminology, she was almost mad at me, like for changing the name, you know?
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, that's a good point, is just right off the bat, use the right terminology and normalize, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why sometimes the kids will say, "How can you say this without laughing?" And I said, "It's not, they're not bad words,
Yes.
right? They're just body parts." And I think if we don't say them, then it seems like we shouldn't. And we talk about time and place, right? Like running around on
Yes.
the playground is not the place to be yelling out names of body parts because,
Yes.
that's not okay, right? But in a
Yes.
educational setting, totally fine.
Well, and just how neat it is for them to be learning that everyone looks different at a young age, because this starts to become a little bit more prevalent, I think, when people are becoming a little more sexually active or more exploratory and they start to realize people look different. I noticed in the, later on, it starts to become very much, I'm not normal. I don't look like so and so. So I think it's good they're getting those messages early on, the differences that people have and for different reasons.
Yeah. Well, even in grade 10, we actually talk about reasons why a person might want to see a doctor with regards to reproductive systems, because we teach about testicular self-exams, breast self-exams. We kind of go through when people should have cervical exams, prostate exams, and even mammograms for that matter. But they also will ask questions like, what's normal? Is it normal that my testicles are different sizes? Is it, normal that I'm, having a period that lasts 2 weeks? There's all kinds of, like, once they've kind of gone through puberty, they want to know, hey, am I experiencing normal things? Right?
What
Yeah.
about on that topic of kind of hormones and puberty? So at those young ages of, let's say, grades 4 and 5 to start with, what are they learning about puberty? Because I think kids are starting to change at that stage sometimes.
Yeah, there's definitely some. So, I mean, we talk about really basic changes initially. So, getting taller, more sweat, more oil production, more hair on the body, armpit hair, pubic hair, and then other hair, depending on what hormone you have. And then we also, I'm trying to think of that. Yeah, so those are sort of the basics. And then we talk about hygiene to do with those changes. But then we go into male reproductive system, and then we're talking about erections, why they happen, and in what sort of situations they might happen. We talk about ejaculations, circumcision, wet dreams. And a lot of kids with wet dreams, they want to know, well, how am I going to know if I've gone to the bathroom, like peed myself at night versus having a wet dream. And then I talk about how, It is normal for even some people in grade five to still be wetting the bed, because I think, I know just from being a mom, I know there's a lot of, especially boys, that worry about that a lot and are really, I guess, embarrassed about the fact that they do. Don't want to go to sleepovers, that kind of stuff. So we talk a little bit about that for the male body. And then for female bodies, the focus is like it's breast development. We're talking about before getting a period, we talk that breast development and vaginal discharge is normal, and then hair growth. And then we talk about kind of preparing for a period, putting a little kit together, why the period happens, what to do when it happens, how, like, the hygiene around, like, pads. In the younger grades, we mention tampons, but we talk about that more in detail as they get older. And we also talk about reusable options, period underwear, menstrual cups, etc., as they get older
So
too.
that
So
when they go home and their parent, let's say, puts together their package or whatever, it's kind of, I've heard of this before. I can see the benefit to that because, and then at least they're in there. If I've done that, I've got my daughter's little bag ready and I can
yeah.
just imagine that she's like, oh my gosh, I am not talking about this with you, mom. If she hadn't heard that in a room of people first, where she knew all of her friends were getting their packages together as well, and that, they're talking openly with their moms about it and kind of excited about the bag they get to pick out to put it in. And I can just appreciate that benefit to hearing it in a group first or second. Maybe they hear it first at home and then, oh, I knew this was coming. Now my friends are learning about it.
And kids, they do, like, because a common question I get asked, because we do anonymous questions usually at the end, starting in grade five and up, but kids will say, well, I'm scared to talk to my parents, or I'm nervous. How do I start the conversation? I'm like, well, this is a great opportunity because you've just had this. Grade four or five, they have a take-home paper that is maybe a talking point to start. But I talk about the fact that parents want to be the ones that kids come to. And I even joke, I'm like, oh, they get excited about it, right? I also talk about one of the best places to have conversations is actually in the car, because you don't have to look each other in the eye. And I have conversations with my kids at night too, sometimes too. But kind of going back with the, what was that? Sorry, I've lost my train of thought now. You had said something
I
and.
think with the kids coming, like their friends or maybe they've heard about it from their parents, and so it's kind of exciting that they know about it or something when they go to
Yeah.
school.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. I was going to say, like, because there's some people that live with only mom or only dad, right? And so they're nervous, like, well, what do I do if I'm at my dad's place? I'm like, well, dads might not be experts on periods. They know they're going to happen and they're going to want you to be comfortable at their house when it happens too. So maybe having discussions, and having someone go with you to buy stuff that maybe knows what they're looking for to keep that at that location too. Right.
That is something, again, I think we're doing a better job of that now, but the number of people that say to me, my parents never talked to me about any of this. And
Yeah.
so I actually grew up with a single dad. My mom passed away when I was young, and my dad did such an amazing job of just pretending that he wasn't. Didn't know anything. He would just say, okay, all right. And he would just show up with pads. I don't know how he figured out what to get, but
Yeah.
I bless him. He always did such a good job of not making my sister and I embarrassed.
Yeah. And which is awesome, right? Like that, that is heartwarming to hear, right? And what some parents do too is if they don't know all this stuff or even remember all this stuff is getting a book. Like quite often kids in classes, I'll sometimes they'll say, who in here has a book on puberty? And in the grade four or five, sometimes grade six classes, I might have, some classes I'll have like 10 hands up, others might have one or two, and everyone's looking at them like, what? But it's really good. Like I know my oldest, my daughter was shyer, and didn't like to have the conversations. My son will like chat my ear off, but so having a book for her was really good. So she could read it and then she would come to me with questions after. So
You have to know
yeah.
your kid, right?
Yep.
One of the other things you talked a little bit about with a penis and the pulling back the foreskin to stay clean. One of the really common things I go over with women as they're older is how to clean the vulva. The number of people that go and spend a lot of money on special soaps and cleansing products, and I always say it's a self-cleaning oven, just water. How do you go over that with kids?
Well, I just remember even from having my own kids, doctors talking about the importance of not using like strong scented products down there, not sitting in bubble baths, and because it can be an irritant to the skin of the labia, right? So I do mention that.
And I think again, I mean, I always tell, like, I would never say to someone, no bubble baths, but if you have a child that is sensitive or that is having irritation, that would be something to consider, right? Yeah, because I think sometimes we think the more fragrance, the more smells are hidden, but the products change the pH of the secretions. This change the pH of the vagina and the vulva so that the bacterial growth isn't optimal and can lead to more infection or irritation. So there's a number of people that are very surprised. I wish I would have just known that simple tip as a child is just not using soaps. So simple.
Totally. I know I had some people, they were like, so we can't have bubble baths? And I said, well, no, you can, but just rinse really, really
Yeah.
well, right? So.
One of the things you mentioned about bedwetting. So this is something that I do hear a lot of with parents saying, what should I do with my child? They're wetting the bed. Number one cause of bedwetting for kids is constipation. And our culture has a lot more kids that are not as active. It's a nightmare sometimes to get kids to eat fruits and vegetables and drink enough water and all of that. And so constipation. Do you ever talk to the kids? Does that come up at all? Like bowel movements and like the
Well,
consistency that your poop should be or anything like that?
we don't really talk about that too much. Like more than anything, like the word bowel or bowel movement comes up if I'm talking about the different openings between their legs, right? We talk about, because a lot of the kids don't know that it's called the anus, they call it the butthole. And so I'll say, you know, it's the anus, and what would be some medical words for poop? And so, and I Yeah, you go to the doctor and maybe you're having stomach problems and doctor's trying to ask you questions to figure out what's going on. They might ask you, when did you have your last bowel movement? So that's how I kind of might get
And
up.
I didn't mean to cut you off, Jenny. Go
No, that's
ahead.
okay. No, that's okay. I'm pretty much done anyway,
I
so.
was just gonna say, I quite often like there are many adults that are constipated too, and the number of them that say, since a kid, I have been constipated. But again, we don't talk about poos very often, and so I think this would be a really important thing for parents to keep their eyes on, because you get to a stage where you're not looking at your kids' poop anymore. They're going, they don't want you to look, it's gross. But we all have different children, and some of them tend to be on the constipated side. But I think, if your kid is having some accidents, whether it be daytime or nighttime, that would be something to look at. And sometimes I tell people to look at their belly. Sometimes their belly looks more distended. They talk about a tummy ache. They spend a lot of time on the toilet is a pretty big sign. Maybe they say they're passing stools, but they might just be bypassing the big stool. And so if you think your child, might be constipated, this would be a good thing to go to your doctor about, because it is a pretty big problem for children that quite often can lead to an adult issue as well. I usually tell kids that it should be easily passable. You shouldn't have to push too hard. It should come out almost like toothpaste, not diarrhea, not too thin or watery, but not hard marbles or have too many cracks in your poop. It should be almost like toothpaste. And it seems to be a really big one. And so quite often people will have to start with sometimes different kind of like medications or supplements to help their kids start having more regular poos, but then come up with a habit, whether we need to drink more water, we need to be more active, we need to think about what we're putting into our body and things like that. That's a big one.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that constipation was like the leading cause of that.
Yeah,
Yeah.
definitely. And it's quite often hard to see because they might have looser stools bypassing the big bulky stool. And so it can be hard to diagnose for a lot of kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know sometimes we'll talk about urine. I'll be like, oh, what color should it be? And they're all like, yellow. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, right.
So
Yes.
that, like drinking water, we talk about that lots. Yeah, because they didn't realize that that's a potential sign of dehydration.
Yeah. And I think that kids, I mean, sometimes the more we nag, the more they don't do what we ask them to. So something as simple as, how's your pee looking? They can be the boss of their water intake instead of us saying drink more, because they just don't know always why we're saying that.
Yeah.
You know, another big one that I find is something, because I see people that come in with poop issues as adults, maybe they can't get it out. They'll say, I cannot. Some people just cannot poo. It's a big production for them to poo, or maybe they have poo leakage. They have pee leakage. They're going pee all the time. And so when I pull out my model and show them that there's muscles that surround the openings that you're talking about with the kids, you know, kind of there's muscles around the pee opening, there's muscles around the vaginal opening, there's muscles around the anus,
yeah.
And that those muscles are supposed to tighten when we don't want to fart or pee or poo, but they need to relax when we sit on the toilet. And there's quite a few kids, I have seen this in one of my children, that there's a lot of pushing when they're just in a hurry. They want to get off the toilet as fast as possible. So a lot of almost like effort goes towards voiding. So that could be a very simple thing too, that I think if you notice, to help kids understand that toileting is a time to relax, you know, take breaths or maybe put their feet on a stool or something like that. But that is an ingrained habit that comes a lot of times from childhood too, is like putting so much effort that the holes close when they're trying to have a bowel movement or a pee. That's another thing for listeners to kind of just something as simple as, oh, the toilet's for relaxing.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I just, even through families that I know, there's, I wouldn't say necessarily elementary, but more so in the middle school, even people will tell me, oh yeah, my kids don't want to go to the bathroom at school.
Yes.
Right. And I'm like, oh my gosh, they're holding it. Like,
yes.
That's not good. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think sometimes that comes from parents. A lot of times people will say to me, I've always had a bit of a phobia with public toilets. They might say my mom was a germaphobe. A lot of people say their mom says, don't go on that toilet. We will wait till we get home. And so I think just checking some of that and noticing that you're passing some of that down, trying to normalize going to the bathroom. I often tell my kids, there's some bathrooms we go into, obviously, that I'm like, oh my gosh, this is disgusting, but they would never know that I'm thinking that.
Yeah.
And I just show them, especially my daughter, how to wipe the seat. Hovering, I get sometimes is, but hovering all the time is not helpful. It's hard to relax your muscles to let your pee and poo come out. So I often just hide the grossness in my body language and show them how to wipe, and obviously make sure they wipe their hands after. But normalizing going to the bathroom outside of your home. I think too, I can't help but bring up too, that lots of kids have anxieties or stresses, you know, not even related to the toilet, but some kids that have issues with pee and poo often have issues with anxiety. And so I think just knowing that if your child is someone that has some of those tendencies, that will affect peeing and pooing, because again, they have a harder time relaxing in general, which probably carries over to the toilet. So I think just being able to put those two and two together, they're very natural process, and it can be disrupted if your child is tends towards stress and anxiety.
Yeah, makes sense.
Jenny, can I shift gears in for a second? And this is a big one that I see a lot of people asking questions around, self-touch. So when you kind of mentioned already, you know, they're learning about their anatomy, you mentioned with, you know, erections or wet dreams, What do you talk about, if anything, in the curriculum about self-touch and what's normal? Because I think this is a hard one. People will tell me I was always shamed for touching myself. My body parts are, that is not to do. I think sometimes it's hard for kids not to do that in public. Can you just talk out loud about that a bit?
Yeah, I guess it comes down to families' values, right? Like some people are told that it's not something that they should be doing. So we kind of approach it from the standpoint of like, it's normal. A lot of times it starts off as like just genuine curiosity about your body and touching. And then when you touch, you might realize that, you know, there's a spot that feels really good when you touch, and that's normal that you would want to keep touching those areas, right? We talk about how some people might choose to do that and some people might choose not to, but it's not something that we do in public. So then I'll say, you know, where would be some good places that, you know, a person might want to do that? And they're like, in your bedroom. I'm like, great, right? You know, some people will say in the bathroom. I'm like, okay, well, what about like every bathroom? And they're like, well, it would be okay in the bathroom at school. I'm like, no, it wouldn't. I'm like, bathrooms in private like places, like private buildings versus not okay in bathrooms in public buildings, right? So we talk about that, and that there's nothing wrong with it. Right? It's your body. You have the right to touch your body, and that everybody else would need permission to touch your body, but you can do what you want. It just needs to be in a private place.
And I have a feeling your answer is not going to be very black and white on this, but I've had a few just kind of conversations with other moms who say, what about when I'm reading to my child at night and I can feel them touching themselves? And it makes me a bit uncomfortable because it's not private, but at the same time, I know that I'm their mom and they're comfortable around me. And it's just, they're relaxing. They're listening to me read and they feel relaxed. I know this isn't a black and white answer, but my tendency was to say, I still think it should be done in private. But this mom was saying, I just feel like I'm always saying, don't. And it's making me think that I'm making that a bad thing.
Yeah. I don't know, because I kind of, with the kids at school, I talk about the fact that, you know, they might be babysitting and same thing, a kid might be doing that around them. And I usually, for them, I would usually say, don't ever say, ew, gross. Why are you doing that? You shouldn't do that. Just say, you know, that's, if you want to do that, that's totally fine, but just not around other people. Right. So if you want to just, even if they want to rest their hands in there, because sometimes it's just like a nice warm place that they put their hands, right? So even if they want to rest their hands, I don't know. I guess it's the comfort level of the parent, right? Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes as parents, we need to give them the guidance that we don't do that around other people, because there have been situations in schools where kids will come and they start doing that because it's like a comfort thing to them and it's not okay, sort of. So sometimes the stuff that we do at home transfers to the school, and so boundaries are really important to be taught.
Yeah. I agree. I absolutely, that makes sense. I want to go a little bit more detail into periods. So, obviously, you know, the whole class is learning about this, which I think is good. I think we used to be separated into girls and boys, and I don't think the boys when I went to school were learning about that. I don't know, but
no, I don't think they were.
How much detail do you go into with the young kids, like the 4, 5, 6s?
At 4s, we don't talk about, like 4s is really basic. It's just like the changes I talked about, like getting taller, sweatier, oily skin, oily hair, you know, body odor. And then we talk briefly like, you're also at some point people, you know, with a vulva, you'll end up getting a period, and, you know, people with a penis and testicles will develop, you know, sperm. But we don't really get into that until grade 5. So at grade 5, we start talking about, I guess, ovulation. So the release of the egg cell, you know, how long that egg cell sort of approximately lives for. We talk about, you know, if a sperm fertilized that egg cell, then the person would become, well, potentially would become pregnant. And so we talk about the uterus, and because a lot of kids still think that babies grow in stomachs. So the uterus or the womb, we talk about that, and we talk about the importance of the blood supply, providing oxygen and nutrition, and so that when someone's pregnant, that they're not going to have a period. So that's kind of where we lead to with that, and that if a person releases an egg and there isn't sperm, which is going to be the majority of the person's life, the egg will disintegrate, and then the bleeding, the blood that was in the uterus won't be needed, and it comes out. So we talk, that's kind of the explanation we give. And then we talk about, okay, so how long, how many days, how, like a lot of kids who haven't maybe learned much about it, they think it's that the bleeding is going to hurt. And we like, the bleeding doesn't hurt. It's like a leaking feeling. It's the cramps, if people get them, that's what might be uncomfortable. How to deal with that. We talk about how, like, that it's coming out quite slowly in general, and that's why it takes so many days. And then that it's coming from the vagina, and that you want to, you can't hold that blood in like you can with pee. So we talk about that's why you need something to put in the underwear to catch the drips when they come out. And so we talk about like pads, panty liners, how often to change them. Putting that kit together, keeping track. Like there's, we talk about a little bit on apps, like the period apps, just, or even on a paper calendar, keeping track. I feel like I'm missing something. Just, yeah, not to be worried about it. I think there's a lot of nervousness about it. And sometimes it, like I remember as a kid growing up having an older sister, and would I would hear her and her friends talking about it, and I don't know if they intentionally tried to exaggerate things to scare me, but then when it happened, I was like, oh, it's not that bad, right? And so just to kind of, if anything, sort of ease their worries, because as long as they even feel prepared for it, then they feel less stressed about it.
When I even just like the fact that you're teaching them to track it and notice, because every single person's menstrual cycle is unique. And I think that to teach them right away, obviously in a group, but then also how to track their own, I think so empowering, because I think, again, that's what a lot of older people will say. I just had no idea. I'm learning this for the first time as my period's almost coming to an end. This could have been very helpful to understand things. And also too, I looked through some of the notes that you sent me about what you teach, and I said, what a neat idea to teach them right away some coping strategies. It like I think in the past, yeah, they used to have a very negative stigma around the period and what a pain in the butt, and I have to take Tylenol and I have to miss school. And I'm not downplaying some people's symptoms. That's not what I'm trying to do. But I think just some of the strategies around understanding that it'll end, or maybe I'll have this pain for a couple of days because I'm tracking it. And then teaching them, yeah, to use heat or exercise, the benefits of exercise for managing pain. Maybe this person also has some stress and anxiety, which is exacerbating the symptoms. And so understanding that maybe they feel more anxious at this time. But again, I think I look at that and I think there's no way my daughter would come home and say she learned all of that. And so for me to see that and say, oh, wow, I feel like I can talk to her in more depth than I have is kind of what I get out of that.
No, I think it's interesting, like, because even earlier we talked about how some kids get really nervous when they're coming in, and kids around their friends, they like to pretend that they're like, oh, that was so gross. And but then kids will come up to us at the end, they'll be like, that was so good, thank you so much, that was really helpful, like I feel better about things now. And I think just helping them, because like honestly, no one really talked to me, and I would just kind of hear my sister, and then my mom was in a generation where she just, it was, I don't know, she just wasn't super comfortable with it. But yeah, I think kids are getting quite a bit of information now. Sometimes, they don't always necessarily hear everything that we're saying, especially if it doesn't apply to their bodies at that moment in time too. And we were saying before about how the boys are in the class too, right? And I think sometimes people are like, well, why do the boys have to hear about it? But years ago, I had this boy, I'll never forget, it was like probably 18 years ago, but he was in a class and he was asking questions about pads and tampons and all sorts of stuff. And his buddies were like, why are you asking this? And he said, if I have, he goes, first of all, he goes, I have a sister. And he goes, and my mom. And he goes, I have friends that are girls. And he goes, if I have a girlfriend and she, gets her period and she doesn't feel great, I want to buy her flowers and chocolates and tampons. And all the girls are like, oh, he's so awesome.
Oh, he had a lot of girlfriends after that, didn't he? No.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
You
Yeah.
know, and I can't believe I'm sharing this in front of so many people, but when I grew, again, my dad was very, he was very easy to talk to, but I was very shy. And I got my period very early, and none of my friends were talking about it, and I didn't know anyone else that did. So I snuck rags, and I put rags in my panties, and I cleaned them myself because I was too embarrassed to tell them. I was embarrassed that I was before my friends, I think is all that it was.
Yeah.
And it came a time where that wasn't convenient anymore, and I needed to tell him. And I remember thinking that wasn't a big deal. He was so supportive. And I think about that now, and I think, I am mortified that my daughter might get her period because she's just getting older. That is all that I'm
No.
like, my, it's a sign that my daughter's getting older, but I don't let her see that. And I try to make it exciting, or not exciting, but just, oh, I actually talk a lot about it, whether they need to know it or not, but, oh, just give me a second, mom. I have my period, so I have to grab something quickly, or give me a second. I have my period, or in the bathroom. And I
Yeah.
say the same things to my son. He's more
Yeah.
of an inquisitive kid, so he
Yeah.
asks a lot of questions, but he gets just as much information. And I'm quick to make sure that I respond when they say things like, ew, gross, mom. They say, oh, it's normal and it's gonna happen to you, you know? And so I think that's a, one of the biggest things we can do as parents is normalize and just talk about our own, because sometimes we don't know how to talk about it for them.
Yeah. I know I had a friend one time who said to me like, oh, how do I talk to my daughter? And like when she was asking me, she was like, how do I talk about that stuff? And I go, first of all, get rid of that face. I said, because like, like if you're cringing, she already can see that you think it's like kind of gross yourself. And so you just, yeah, put on that sort of straight matter of fact face and just make everything normal. Yeah.
What about, so you meant you've touched on it, but I just want to be clear so that I understand this. So what about the, you talked about periods, and if someone doesn't have a period, and you know, if the sperm fertilizes the egg. So does that come up as like the sex talk in school? Do you bring that up in school, or do you just talk about sperm and egg?
Well, like we'll talk about the like sperm production. We talk about egg ovulation, et cetera. But then, like in my early days when we didn't have a lot of time, and we wouldn't explain in as much detail, even like me, a young teacher at the time too. But kids would always ask, "Well, how does the sperm get to the egg?" Right? And it's like there's nothing wrong with them knowing the truth. And we just say it in a very factual way. We say, we usually will say these are adult activities. And it requires consent. So then we get into a topic about what that, is, all about and, making sure that both people are aware of what the other person's asking them and that they're okay with it. Then we talk about keep it really sort of scientific. When someone has an erection, the erect penis would get put into the vagina, and then they would have their ejaculation and release their millions of sperm. And some kids have heard that, but other kids, mentioned, oh God, I've never heard that before. My parents would make up stuff about where, like, oh, they bought me at Costco, or I'm like, it's okay to tell kids the truth. And honestly, I think the earlier the better, because kids when they're young don't think it's gross. They're like fascinated by it all, right? And they think, well, is that going to hurt? And no, it doesn't hurt, right? Yeah.
So
So.
then I have a question for you. So I feel like that makes, yes, that makes sense if the question's there. Like I can picture, I have two different kids. One of them is inquisitive and one doesn't want to know. And so What like I that seems easy for me if they come up and ask me where it comes from. But in the event that we have a child, or that anyone listening has a child that kind of doesn't want you, they feel awkward. They don't tend to ask a lot of questions. Any suggestions for how to bring that up? Because I'll be honest with you, when I looked at what you talk about, I was like, oh my gosh, I have to have the talk soon. I don't want her to hear from someone else before me. But I just feel like if I brought it up, she would be so uncomfortable. So how do you bring it up if they don't ask? If they're not ready for it, I guess I'm sorry to go back, but I think I've always heard the advice, tell them when they're ready. And so I guess maybe the lack of questions makes me feel that they're not ready and I don't want to shove it down the throat.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think kids are more ready than parents give them credit for, too. I mean, everyone knows their child best, but if people are talking about growing up and whatnot, I mean, I think it would be good for parents to kind of navigate towards, this is how babies, are made. Like sometimes kids will say things like, well, and the seed from the male, has to fertilize. So they get that, but they just don't know what takes for that to happen. And again, the other thing too is it's not always heterosexual couples, right? There's some families where there's two females or two males, and so we talk even just generally sometimes, like, does anyone, like, some because some kids will say, like, how do two moms have babies, right? And so a lot of kids actually know about sperm donation too. But anyways, I would try to have the talk, about how a sperm gets to the egg before they, I don't know, before they come into our class for sure. Because
Absolutely.
I've had some kids who, when I talk about it, that's the first time they're hearing it. And like some of them, I still remember one, they were like, how come no one told me?
I know.
And they're like, and then they're looking around, they're like, does everyone else know? And the kids are like,
I know.
right? And then they felt embarrassed for not knowing.
Exactly.
So I think, if you hear, hey, your child's going to have sexual health, like just put it all out there and just realize that there might be some embarrassment, but, or like, an awkwardness with it, but they're going to appreciate having been told then compared to like it being this big taboo thing that you didn't want to tell them kind of thing.
Absolutely. So on that note, so that would be, and I think I heard your last comment or one of the other comments is like, do it in the car or somewhere where you're not looking face to face. Absolutely. And I, like I said, I'm listening to all your suggestions around leaving books in the room and everything. It's just a matter of, yeah, figuring out how to best deliver that to your own child. So I think if I was to summarize some of the other suggestions, and so far we've only talked about like elementary school age kids, but talk to them when they're young, right? Like start right from the get-go with the right terminology and just be open. I've always heard like just a little bit more every year. You don't have to give them the whole spiel the very first time you start talking, but just build on it all the time as they're ready, right? That let them know they can always come to you. And it sounds like, you know, through body language, not only your facial expressions, but the way that you respond when they ask questions, but really try to put some of your past experiences aside as maybe how you were parented or how your parents dealt with it. Try your best to kind of put on a brave face and answer it in a way so that they feel comfortable coming back again.
I know, like, I think from even my generation, the biggest thing that when the program started up years ago, everyone's like, well, why are they all together? Why are we teaching everyone together? And, I think it's amazing, I think, when I look at, like, the kids don't know any different. So learning all together, maybe they don't ask as many questions as if they were separate, who knows? But that's where parents come in and to support the program. But by the time they get to the high school, even middle school or high school grades, like they are so comfortable talking with stuff around each other, which is really good because ideally that's what you want when they enter into a relationship, is to be able to talk to partners about things, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
And that the point that people need permission to touch them. So you've talked about that, but I think that I remember having these discussion with my kids when they were young is, you know, you describe that, you know, you show them the parts and that these are your body parts. You're the boss of your own body type of thing. You know, you can ask mom and dad to look at things if you know, if anything feels uncomfortable or itchy or sore or anything.
Yeah.
What do you say then? And I remember having conversations before about going to the doctor and the doctor having to look at their private parts and explaining that. Like, there was one time actually my son said he wasn't comfortable with the doctor looking. And so we were kind of like, oh, what do we do?
I know, because, you know, I tell the kids, you know, yeah, if sometimes doctors might need to have a look in areas if there's not, like, there's something that you're worried about, and that they will, like, they should be saying, you know, can I have a look? Like, they're asking your permission first, but that a lot of them might choose to have a parent in the room to make them feel more comfortable. Or even as they get older, you're welcome to have, like, the nurse in the room. So just as another body, just if it's, you know, if you're worried at all about any situation, but that it might feel weird that a doctor might have to look at those areas, but that's, they're just looking at you. It's not like you're just almost like a body, like you're, it's not weird for them. They're just trying to figure out and solve the puzzle, basically, of what's going on with you. Right.
And then what kinds of things do you say around, like, how would you frame to them when it's not okay for someone to touch them?
We talk about that, like that feeling, right? Like, trusting their instincts, trusting their gut. Like, if something, even if, like, it's a touch on the shoulder that, like, it's like a squeeze and they're like, oh, I don't like the way that felt, right? The importance of talking to a trusted adult about it. But yeah, like, it's basically to try to reduce the chances of them being victims of child sexual abuse is knowing their body parts. If anything seems unusual, you know, to talk with somebody, but so that they aren't doing things to other people too. But trying to think of my wording here. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, like, we talk about the importance of, it's not just like touch with private parts, but asking permission for hugs, right? Hey, can I put my arm around you? Like, so starting, and like, as parents, not forcing kids to give relatives a hug goodbye if they don't like affection. Some kids are not affectionate. Like, I still remember my own daughter when she was three, I was reading a book to her in bed, and, you know, I'm snuggling up next to her after, and she just looks at me, she goes, you can go now. Like, she's just like, she's never been like a cuddler or a huggy, and like, that it's okay to be like that, right? It doesn't matter if it's someone that you trust or not, that it's okay. You know your boundaries and you know your comfort level, and that we don't want to make other people feel uncomfortable. Right? So don't assume that because you're huggy that the other person's going to be huggy too. Or, but yeah, just, we talk about, you know, boundaries at school. Some kids think it's funny, and they usually do it to their friends. They'll, you know, go up and like hit their bum, or they think it's funny to pull their pants down, and like, that's not okay. So we talk about that leading into, basically, it becomes sexual harassment, and then they can get suspended. So we kind of, sorry, I feel like I'm babbling on this, but
no, I think it's important.
Yeah.
I think of some of the adult clients that I have that have had a lot of medical trauma is a big one. And so I speak a lot with them about, you know, we're used to going into a doctor's office and doing things quickly, like that they do a speculum exam or a pap exam very quickly, or that they check certain things that we don't want them to, but you do know you don't have to say yes to that. And they're often like, I don't. I'm like, of course not. You don't, this is your body. But I, again, I think We grew up in a different time where it was kind of like you listen to the doctor, you listen to the authority kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's a little bit more like, well, yes, you have to respect authority, but you don't have to do those things, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think starting that language at a young age is very helpful. And then also too, you mentioned just kind of discuss secrets that you keep and secrets that you shouldn't keep. I think that's a big one. Sometimes it's hard for kids to know which secrets are good and which are bad.
Yeah, because in the school sometimes, like I'll say to the kids, how many of you have heard about stranger danger? And they all raise their hands. They feel pretty confident by the time I see them in grade four, like what to do if a stranger, were to touch them or whatever. But we talk about that, hey, sometimes it could be, most of the time with kids, it's someone that they and that you trust, right? And so everyone needs permission. Sorry, you were saying something before. This is my menopausal brain.
No, I get it. I
Like
get it.
kind of going off in tangents.
No, it was just more just about keeping, like, knowing which
All the
secrets to keep
secrets.
and which not. You know, another way I was thinking about this, that how I tell stories to my kids, because my kids don't like lessons, if that makes sense. Like, if I come to them and say, I need to tell you something that's very important, they kind of are like, Mom, stop it. I make up a lot of stories that are not true, meaning I often blame my clients and I'll say, do you know what? You guys, I had a client today. Listen to this. And it's not true, but I just, they'll, if I see, let's say, something in the paper or someone tells me about, you know, a sexual trauma case or something like that, I'll be like, okay, this is a teaching lesson here, but I can't make it a teaching lesson. I'll make it a story. And so quite often I'll say, this is what a client told me. Her daughter was at a sleepover with a friend, and the dad or the older brother or something like that did this. And this is what happened. And so I'll just kind of, I'll make something up and try to get them to picture that and say, okay, let's say that, let's, I said, and that kid thought they were going to get in trouble. They thought that they'd get in trouble because they knew that family. I said, for example, what if you, I'm just going to use you as an example, Jenny, if you went over to Jenny's house for a sleepover and this is what happened at her house, and she said you'd get in trouble if you told me, that's not true. I mean, I said in that example, Jenny probably needs some help. She's having issues with some things. And I, because Jenny's our friend, we would try to help her find help, but that's not your fault. And you're never going to get in trouble. And Jenny's not going to get in trouble from us. She's going to get help from us or something like that. So I make up a lot of things that way. And I find for my kids, that's well received. But just another strategy.
No, absolutely. Yeah, because I think, some kids do worry, because the secrets, like we talk about how sometimes people will try to tell them that they like it's a, like they'll make it into a game if they're touching someone appropriately, or they'll to make it seem like this is normal for this age, or they'll say, this is our little secret, don't say anything. And we talk about the importance of you, those are the secrets that you do not keep. They're asking you to do that because they don't want to get in trouble, right? But if, the importance of, they know what they're doing is wrong, they're just hoping that you don't know. Right. And so you've got to say something. And if you tell an adult and they aren't helping you, then you go get another adult's help. Right. So so we have some lots of conversations around that too. Like a little bit of the manipulation or, tricking kids because they believe things so easily too, right? And they especially if it's someone that they know, they don't want to get the person in trouble. They don't want to, like it's confusing for kids. Why would someone who possibly cares about me, why would they do this to me?
Well, is there anything else, Jenny? I'm really quite happy with everything we were able to cover for kind of those elementary ages. Is there anything you feel like I didn't ask about that we should have talked about?
With the elementary grades?
Yeah.
I think we got most of the topics in.
And I look forward to having you back. I want to kind of do a part two of this so we can talk about what how that conversation extends to kind of middle years, like kind of 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. what they're learning, because this is another thing that we're having to navigate, right? Especially with all this social media.
Oh,
And
yeah.
so I thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to extending this conversation to the next episode.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me.
And that's a wrap. If you enjoyed the show, can I ask you a big favor? Would you do one of three things for me? Number one, leave a review, because we could all use a little positive feedback sometimes. Number two, download the episodes, because it helps me see what people are interested in. Or number three, share it with somebody else, because sharing is caring. Catch you next time.